Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Pun Intended Podcast, your spot and podcast for Dynasty Fantasy Basketball Analysis and a Sports Ethos production. I am your host, Mark C., the Dynasty leader over at Sports Ethos. You can find me on Twitter at MacAttack145 and my writings and rankings over at SportsEthos.com. Let's get right into it today with the recent trender topic, and that is the NBA playoffs and play-ins are about to kick off. Now, I am recording this Saturday, so I don't know the results of some of these games, but at this point, we know all the teams that are going to be in the playoffs and the play-ins. Just as an NBA fan, let alone Dynasty Fantasy basketball fan, I love the NBA playoffs and all the just great basketball that's played. The March and April weeks, while are interesting in one aspect, they're also March and April basketball games, so it's really just a great shift to get into the playoff atmosphere and the playoff basketball that's going to get placed, and I can't wait to see how they play out. Of course, we could just have the Celtics and the Nuggets steamrolling both their conferences, and I hope that's not the case, but I wouldn't be upset if that is. They are two amazing teams, and I think that would be for a very fun finals. But as they say, that's why they play the games. Who knows what can happen? And I think really the middle of these playoffs is going to be super interesting. The play-in games in the Western Conference could be crazy, which is lots of potential fallouts and franchise decisions from those results. If the Lakers or Warriors don't make it, that would be pretty crazy, but really interesting to see how those franchises move forward. But let's bring it back a little bit, and almost a reminder to myself, this is a Fantasy Dynasty pod. So the question we need to ask ourselves is, what can we glean from the playoffs that will help us improve our dynasty teams? And so we have to remember, first off, that playoffs aren't this regular season. They are not the same. Teams can scout a lot heavier in the playoffs, knowing their opponent and knowing we're going to play this team for at least four or five games. And you can really hone in on specific matchups, individual defensive schemes to shut down your opponent. And sometimes players just have rough matchups and they don't look great. Someone like Domantas Sabonis last year struggled heavily against the Warriors. He really couldn't overwhelm Draymond Green with his strength, or Kevon Looney for that matter, and just did not look like the same player. But we know he's still a great Dynasty Fantasy player. He still had a great year in that regard and put up great counting stats for your team with points, rebounds, and assists, and efficiency from the field. Yeah, on the other end of the spectrum, you have players like Jamal Murray and Jimmy Butler who just seem to turn it up for the playoffs. Murray has been a player who's, if you just look at his playoffs, he's been an all-star or all-NBA level and just been fantastic. But whether it's due to some injury management or just him not having that non-clutch regular season gene, I don't know what to call it, but his regular season has not been the same as the playoffs. And that's what really affects our dynasty production. You look at an older player like Jimmy Butler, who it's clear that he'll take the regular season easy, and he just turns it on in the playoffs, being so much more aggressive in his drives and looking for his own shot. And that's not to say that we can't identify these players and how just they are relative to the league, but we have to look at what their regular season production is at the end. We have to weigh that a little more than the playoffs, and probably not just a little more, but a decent amount more. Our dynasty teams, right, playoffs might even be, you know, beginning of March and end there. So that's so far from the playoffs. We don't get credit for playoff production. At the same time, we have to keep in mind that how these teams and players play in the playoffs may dictate future franchise decisions. So if the Cavs lose early on, is Donovan Mitchell going to be out? There's already been rumors circulating that if there's no extension in place, the Cavaliers are just going to look to recoup what they can for Donovan Mitchell. And that just makes sense from a franchise decision. But that would have probably some ramifications, or would definitely have ramifications, on some of these players' dynasty outlooks and their values. So that could be to whatever team Donovan Mitchell is traded to. That could be whatever the return is, whether it's picks or players, and would affect the players and their short-term outlooks on the Cavaliers themselves. So we're talking players like Darius Garland would be the big one, but Evan Mobley and Jared Allen as well. for the Los Angeles Clippers. If they lose to the Mavs early, what will PG-13 do? Paul George? Well, it's, you know, he's going to be a free agent. There hasn't been an extension in place. You would think if there was a max extension on the table, he already would have taken it. So does he look for a different team at that point? What will James Harden do? Now, I kind of talked about some older, more established teams, and let's turn to the younger teams in the playoffs. It's important to note how these players perform in their first playoff settings and how teams scheme against them to help identify maybe some of their weaknesses. Again, these might be more playoff weaknesses than regular season weaknesses and may not have the most correlation with how we project the player's stats to be, but it will tell us how a team might view a player. So, using the Thunder as an example, Josh Giddey, if he just becomes unplayable in the playoffs due to his lack of shooting and lackluster defense, then, yeah, the Thunder shouldn't view him as a key piece going forward. And another team would probably have some doubts too. We've talked about the Thunder last week, so I'm not going to go as in-depth on the Josh Giddey situation, but that's definitely something we have to be aware of. This could be a little revealing in where teams might believe his future is as a piece in the rotation or in the starting lineup. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams, they could struggle in their first playoffs. It's actually not Shai's first playoffs. He's been in the playoffs a couple of times, but this is definitely his first playoffs as the key player. He's going to get schemed against. Teams are going to focus all the defensive efforts on him. And so if both Shai and Jalen Williams struggle, well, it's kind of their first playoffs as these players, so it seems weird to give them a bit of a mulligan, but they'll get a little bit of a pass. But I do want to see how they are schemed against and how they attack and how they counter offensively and see if those counters exist in their bag already. On the other side, if, let's say, Jalen Williams goes off and goes crazy, okay, well, then that's going to be, it's going to be hard to contain the hype at that point because it's just showing he can do it at an elite level, which he's done already well this regular season. What if Chet Holmgren goes crazy? What if he just excels, walks down the paint, really keeps up that rebounding well, which is his one kind of weakness right now? If he does it all, then holy moly, this team is going to be very exciting. Teams like the Magic and the Pacers have their first taste in the playoffs with this core. We'll get into more detail later, but those are definitely two teams that we're going to keep an eye on. Zion Williamson, this is his first playoffs. Yes, I know, that sounds maybe a bit surprising, but it's true. It's his first playoffs. The times the Pelicans have made it, he's either been out or injured. And he is definitely one of those players that has a pretty clear offensive attacking system and style and some pretty clear weaknesses. I am very curious how teams will attack him, how he will attack them, and how defense is set up against him. I think this is going to be a big litmus test for me on where Zion Williamson is and how he can progress and could dictate what the Pelicans do in the future. So, I mean, I just went over a couple of the storylines for the playoffs that I'll be tracking from a dynasty perspective, but there's going to be tons more. We can think we know how the playoffs are going to go, but we're going to have no idea until they actually unfold and they actually play out. So just one other thing I want to touch on again, much like we talked about with March Madness scouting, we have to keep in mind that they're not single game samples, but they are single series samples potentially against specific teams. Sometimes the matchups just aren't great. There are stylistic clashes. We talked about Sabonis against Green and Looney last year, and we have to keep that in mind. If a player doesn't look great, or if a player underperforms, or if a player just isn't hitting his shots, or if they're going a hot streak, it could be a one sample. We have to keep all those factors in mind. That brings into play really a lot of what we talked about in the past month here. Hot streaks, single game sample sizes, single opponent scouting. So keeping all that in mind when looking at the playoffs from a fantasy perspective, I think is really crucial. And basically, don't go overboard with your analysis and making these projections based off playoff runs. I think that can be a little bit of a slippery slope. If you did that with Jamal Murray and think this was his season, you were probably a little disappointed. that isn't to say Jamal Murray had a bad fantasy season, but if you extrapolated his playoff run last year to this year, you'd be a little disappointed. So temper expectations a little bit based on what happens, but still look for potential storylines, not storylines, but team directions that could change based on how they are attacked and how they perform in the playoffs. This is obviously a results-driven league, and results are going to drive what teams do. And we need to be aware of that as dynasty managers so we can pounce on what we think, I guess, on what opportunities we think could open up down the road. Now, let's get into some players on the upswing. And first, we're going to talk about D'Angelo Russell, guard for the Los Angeles Lakers. And I know I'm probably hearing some groans at his name come up, and I get it. I don't love the player on court for a high-level team. The operative phrase there is high-level team. And I know he's on the Lakers now, and Lakers fans seem to have a very love-hate relationship with him. Because, yeah, I have questions about his on-court play as well. We'll get into some of that later. But just as we were talking about, we care about his regular season production and how that impacts our dynasty teams. And the fact of the matter is, D'Lo has put up pretty good production for a couple years running now. He is a great shooter with volume, takes his opportunities well, can play on ball and off ball. He has pushed his threes to make about three per game on solid efficiency. That's solid. I like that. He is also a very capable ball handler and passer, totaling over 6 assists for the third straight season. He does D'Angelo Russell your offense a little bit. He kind of is a slow, plodding, methodical pace, and you could argue that there are other ball handlers that you'd rather have. So I would probably rather put the ball in LeBron James' hands is more in crunch time. But that's not to say D'Angelo Russell is bad at it. There are just probably better options. He's more of a acceptable option. Russell also is fairly efficient from the field. He even racks up some steals as well. It's not a great amount, and I'm not going to say he's a huge boon to your field goal percentage, but it's not in the case where it's just a complete negative and a complete sieve there. It's fine. It's acceptable, and it's very passable for your team. So why is there so much hate for Russell? I think this is a case where we let our on-court perception of him cloud some of our dynasty perceptions of him. And I talked about it earlier. He does kind of D-lows your offense. He kind of controls it a bit, goes at his own tempo, and isn't really beating his guy or creating these huge advantages. And, I mean, we've seen him with other teams in the past, on the Nets, on the Wolves, and honestly, teams did look better when they moved on from him. But hey, there's a place for a capable enough point guard who can just run the offense competently and set up players and do what you need to do on the offensive end. I'm not going to sit here and say that he is some all-star level point guard, even though he did make the team once. But he's not an all-star level point guard. He's not in the top 10, probably not even top 15 point guards in the league. But that's okay. That's okay. He doesn't have to be for him to put up fantasy numbers. And talking about his defense, just to get, I guess, finish out the on-court discussion. Yeah, he's a negative on defense. He's someone you have to scheme around rather than scheme with. I know there was that stretch on the Wolves where there were some articles and stuff that, oh, he's really communicating. He's leading the defense by communication. I mean, I definitely don't buy that. It's pretty clear watching him that he has been a part of good defenses, but it's more in spite of him rather than because of him. But again, that's fine. There's a fair amount of teams in the league that could use what he brings, even if it's more above an acceptable baseline, rather than really elevating the team up. I think a team like the Magic could just use a shooter, guard, someone who could pass up top that is not named Paolo Banchero, just to help alleviate that load. I think he'd be a decent fit there. It may be a short-term fit. It may not be something that would last a long time, but on a 1 or 2 year deal, sure. I think that's perfectly fine and acceptable, and the Magic salary structure could handle that. Unless we forget, he's only 28 years old. He is firmly in his prime. I don't think we're going to see any decline of skills anytime soon. I don't think that should be the expectation. The real uncertainty is just his landing spot in his contract. So I touched on that a little bit, but diving into that, he has a $17 million player option, and I could see it going either way, and it really could depend on how these playoffs go for him and the Lakers, if he picks that up or if he decides to decline and test the market. But wherever he lands, I honestly expect him to see good minutes and a good role. This could be whether he, signs somewhere else or the Lakers trade him, because that $17 million could be very good salary ballast and matching in a trade. For whether it be, DeJounte Murray, could the Lakers get Trae Young? That's a whole nother discussion. I don't want to open that can of worms and get into that. But yeah, I just think Russell, wherever he lands, he's probably going to see good minutes and probably see a good role, just because he does things pretty well. Not great, but pretty well. And you'll get those points, triples, assists, all at line efficiency. That's a player I'm pretty interested on my dynasty squad. And I understand that he's not going to be someone that you see on your roster in your guard spot and you feel confident about going forward. And you can say, this guy is locked in for 5 years. I don't feel comfortable with that, because I don't know what team he's going to be on. His contract situation is clearly very fluid, and he's moved all on a lot. He's moved through a lot of teams in his past, but he's also put up numbers on all those teams as well. And ultimately, I just think he is talented enough that he'll see a role, and we probably shouldn't let that uncertainty override the production that we've seen from him. The next player we'll talk about on the upswing is Isaiah Hartenstein, center for the New York Knicks. He took a stranglehold on the Knicks center position once Mitchell Robinson went down with injury. And yes, Hartenstein has dealt with his own injuries throughout the year, but since he's come back, he's been really solid. And you don't need me to sit here and tell you that, oh, wow, yeah, Hartenstein, wow, yeah. Obviously, he's been doing great, so he's good. But I think he's a really interesting player, especially from the center spot, and I really want to dive into him. Part of the love for him is that Hartenstein is a multifaceted player. And personally, I don't necessarily shy away from, I call them few category impact players. So think about your centers like Mitchell Robinson or Walker Kessler or Nick Claxton, who are mainly, boards, focal percentage, blocks players. I don't necessarily shy away from those. But obviously, a player like Hartenstein, who can do a lot of things nicely, are nice. I don't know another way to put it, but they're just players like Hartenstein, who can do a lot for your team and do it well, are that is inherently valuable. He is one of the better passing big men in the league. I think that's very fair to say. He is about a 13 assist percentage per cleaning the glass, which is very solid, and it's in that upper echelon of NBA bigs. He is only averaging 2.5 assists per game, so that doesn't seem great, but the assist percentage is encouraging, and it's pretty clear watching him that he has some real skills there with his vision and handoff game, working out of that short roll, finding cutters along the baseline for easy duck-ins at the rim, and it is just clear that he can do more than other centers, and you can involve him in your offense, and he's probably someone you want touching the ball in your offensive sets. Looking at just traditional center things, he does all that extremely well. He has strong rebounding rates both on the offensive and the defensive end, something that's just obviously important for fantasy and on the court. And he is one of the better rim protectors in the league, looking at defended field goal percentage at the rim for the past 2 seasons. I mean, there's obviously been not the largest sample of minutes, but doing it over 2 years does provide a pretty decent sample, and we can probably feel confident saying, okay, Hartenstein is a good center defender. And that's at minimum we can say that. He's probably even better than just a good NBA defensive center. But he's also talking about this multifaceted aspect again. He's a little more mobile than just a drop coverage center. He can get on the court a little bit and execute a variety of schemes, whether it be hedging, playing up top, showing. I'm trying to think of, now I don't also want to spat out phrases for defensive role coverages, but he can hedge, he can stay up enough at the point of attack and just do that, which not all centers can do. So I really like that aspect of his game. He boasts a 2.4% steal rate on the year, which is excellent for a big. So he's not just providing those blocks, he's not just providing those rebounds, he's also adding those steals and assists to his game, layering on the categories he impacts for your team. His only real flaw for fantasy is the lack of points and threes, which that's fine. This is a center. And yeah, obviously, if he was a huge scorer, I mean, that'd be incredible. That would be amazing. That's fine. Getting those assists and steals from your center spot and that extra versatility, super valuable for his floor on a nightly basis, and bet his ceiling if he has a game where just he stacks up stats in all these different categories. Now, talking about his contract and future situation, he is going to be an expiring free agent, and some could see that as a negative, since there is that uncertainty with him. But talking to my Knicks friends, they're all pretty set that Hartenstein, if he comes back to the Knicks, would be the starting center over Mitchell Robinson. Now, the Knicks can only offer the early bird contract to Hartenstein, but that will be a little more than the middle exception that other teams can offer him, and I think that should be enough for Hartenstein to stay with the Knicks if he chooses so, and if the Knicks choose to offer him that contract. Now, if Hartenstein were to be lured away, it's most likely either for the money and the role. I would say it's probably both aspects. And hey, that's also a positive for his value as well. I will take Hartenstein being the clear-cut center on a team. So ultimately, I think Hartenstein has shown enough to believe in him wherever he lands, whether it's the Knicks or another team. And we shouldn't really be too worried about his uncertainty. He's just talented enough that he's going to see, I would say, at worst, similar minutes in that 25 minutes game. But if those were to shoot up even higher, yeah, we could really see him just shoot up the rankings even further. Now, his durability is a bit of a concern as well, but players get injured. I don't think this is anything super lasting, and we still saw him put up good numbers, even with a bit of an injury-filled season this year, so I'm okay taking on a little bit of that risk for the upside that Isaiah Hartenstein has. Now, let's get in some players on the downswing. And first, we'll discuss Jaren Jackson Jr., forward slash center for the Memphis Grizzlies. The Grizzlies have had a really cursed season, so it could be easy just to give Jackson a bit of a mulligan for this season. And I partly do, but I also think we saw some worrying signs from him that caps his upside. Yes, his points were up, his assists were slightly up, but it was a little bit of a trade-off of bad efficiency, more turnovers. So obviously I didn't like that, and the Grizzlies were just such a mess that someone had to take that usage. To be fair to him, his shot diet was much harder and didn't really have someone setting him up. And some of his front court running mates, like Steven Adams and Brandon Clark, were out for the season. So he wasn't afforded the opportunity to be a defensive roamer. Shouldn't we take that into account some? Well, just as we talked about with Hartenstein and his multifaceted ability, I think we actually saw Jackson Jr. not display that this year. Jaren Jackson Jr. didn't really excel in self-creation aspects on the offensive end, nor be a defense by himself. Let's talk about the defensive side first. His blocks obviously fell off this year, but so did his rim protection numbers, as the lone center really on the team. So I question if maybe Jaren Jackson just needs another big man with him on the court to help him with the interior, or just allow him to be more of a roamer than that drop coverage big. And if he can't play it as effectively in more varied schemes, his versatility is a little more narrow than what we thought previously. Another worrying sign for me was his already poor rebounding rates dropped even more. And that's been one of his biggest critiques, I think, not just from the Dynasty fantasy community, is that his rebounds from the big spot is pretty lacking, but also on court and just the opportunities he allows with his poor rebounding. And even with more time as a lone big, he couldn't improve there, which means that, yeah, he might just need to play with another big on the court. And That's problematic for another reasons. So because we saw him be a little limited there on the defensive end, that means that normally I don't love this classifying players as bigs and saying bigs can't shoot, but if you need a bigger player to play next to Jaren Jackson Jr., it's more likely than not they're not facing the floor, spacing the floor. And that means that his offensive stretchability is neutered a little bit. And it'd be nice if Jaren Jackson Jr. could be this four-facing five full-time, but I don't think that's really been the case, and we haven't seen that. And even in a lost season, I think that might have been punctuated this season. That would hinder his upside and cap it a little bit for his fantasy game, and I think for his overall performance and his production. Now, getting into the offensive end a little deeper, yes, the shot diet was harder, and the team slate and rotations were just an absolute mess. At the same time, I don't think that really excuses or explains the drop-off from field goal percentage going from 50.5 to 44.5. His percentage of self-assisted shots, sorry, not self-assisted shots, his percentage of shots that were assisted by others obviously shot way down, and that's just going to yield harder shots, more difficult looks, more contested opportunities. That's not going to fully explain that drop-off. It's not. I do expect that to bounce back, obviously, with Ja Morant and Desmond Bane healthy this year. But the larger point, really, is there's nothing to suggest here that his offensive game can ramp up or improve up to the level of something of that of a second option. I just don't think he has that in his bag. He is basically probably just a third option better playing off of someone else creating those opportunities and advantages for him. So all of these factors being said, I think there's just a lot less ceiling and upside than what we saw. And he's still young. He can still improve. But we're seeing that improvement really taper off and maybe even take a bit of a step back. So without that upside, his individual production and ceiling, his individual fantasy ceiling in an individual year just might be a lot lower. And so he's going to drop off, especially if others have just risen past him and have demonstrated a better, more projectable ceiling than Jaren Jackson Jr. has shown. The next player we'll get into on the downswing is another big, Nikola Vucevic of the Bulls. And I know he's put up pretty respectable surface level numbers again, but his effectiveness per play type is just down across the board, just straight up down. The short of it that can be seen in his field goal percentage dropping from 52 to 48%, and his 3-point percentage dropping from 35% to a ghastly 29%. But it's really deeper than that. I think it's important to look at why that is the case. And it's pretty simple. Just on every play type, he's not only worse, but he's just actively bad. His post-ups, his spot-ups, his finishing on pick and rolls, his pick and pops, they're all worse than they have been in previous years. And doing what he does on the volume he has is some baseline level of good, because you're probably replacing other bad possessions, such as an Andre Drummond post-up, for instance. Nobody wants to see that. That's not going to be an effective offense. At the same time, you still have to be decent enough in that volume you're getting, and he is far from that spot. He does not have the profile of a player that you want to invest your offensive possessions in. And recognizing that means we should probably expect some of his counting stats to go down just with less usage, and some of his fantasy stats to go down in the future. And I haven't even begun to touch on his defense yet, where he is probably one of, if not the worst bigs in the league that is getting significant starting minutes, or significant rotation minutes for that matter. He's slow, immobile, you have to warp your defensive scheme to fit around him, and just isn't good at protecting the rim. He doesn't really contribute too much there, just besides being big and providing some solid defensive rebounding. The only saving grace, really, for Vucevic is his contract in the team state. He has 2 years left at around $20 million a year, and no one wants that contract. No serious team wants that contract, and with his age creeping up, no rebuilding team's really going to want that either. And then looking at the Bulls and where they're at, they're going to try to make the play-in and get that revenue, it looks like. They still haven't made the decision to rebuild yet, even though it's clear that the ceiling of this team has already been reached. I very much doubt that the Bulls are going to try to acquire anyone better than Vucevic, so he's probably fairly entrenched in this role for the next 2 seasons, and he probably will accumulate some volume stats in good minutes. That's really the only saving grace here for him. We can probably expect him to put up similar minutes, but there is going to be a cliff coming, and he's probably already met the cliff of Father Time. We talked about players like D'Angelo Russell earlier today, and DeAndre Ayton a few weeks ago, and how their on-court ability and our dislike for that could mask some of their fantasy game in the value. And there's probably a little bit of this going on here with me on Nikola Vucevic, where I'm basically saying he's not a good starting center and should be replaced, but he probably won't be for the contract reasons we just discussed. But he's going to be nearly 34 at the beginning of next season. The ability's already waning, and there's a lot of red warning signs that Vucevic is not a good player. Not a good starting player, rather. So if you roster him, you're probably stuck with him. And you should probably just reap what production you can and hope that he continues to see starter minutes and just gets the volume stats just by virtue of playing a good amount of minutes and having to be involved in the offense. But this is not a player you want to look to acquire and trade for unless it's a pretty cheap value. So just be wary that there's going to be little bounce back potential here, little upside here, and you're really just relying on those minutes and counting stats. That's really the hope of Nikola Vucevic. Lastly, we'll get into some teams to watch going into the playoffs. And we already mentioned the two of them earlier. The first of those will be the Orlando Magic. Really, a really great year for them. But they've been a team that I've been just mystified at their win totals because the defense for the Magic is amazing. They have great intensity, great depth, great length and size across the positional spectrum. But I have no clue how the heck the Magic offense stacks up in a playoff setting. Their offense has been pretty poor this year. As much as we hope Paolo Banchero can lead the offense, and he's probably worthy of a more in-depth discussion later at a future point, he is quite far from driving good offense. I know he made the All-Star team, but I thought honestly that was a horrible selection, and he had no business sniffing the All-Star team or even being as inconsiderate for me. That's how much I think his offense is away from being positive at this point in time. Just like we discussed with Nikola Vucevic, he does it at such a volume that inherently has value because someone has to dribble the ball, someone has to take the shots. Even factoring that in, though, it's still a ways away from where it needs to be on the offensive end for Paolo Banchero. So I do wonder how he's going to stack at the playoff level, how teams will play him, and can we just basically see him be effective? Will we have games where he puts it all together, that mid-range shot is going in, and he's getting to the line and really pushing the Magic to a passable offense? Similarly, Franz Wagner is someone to keep an eye on as well. He's been nice in his role, but he isn't also a great individual driver or offense yet. He isn't doing it at as anywhere close to the volume that Paolo Banchero has, and his three ball has dipped a little bit down. He is a fantastic driver, fantastic at getting to the rim and generating good looks, but I would like to see him flesh out his game a little more and increase his volume and usage. Can he do that in the playoffs? I'm not entirely sure, especially when teams have a chance to really hone in on his tendencies. I'm really going to keep an eye on those two on the offensive end when those scouting reports are going to tighten up in the playoffs. Looking at Jalen Suggs, who we went in depth in a few weeks ago, will we be able to keep up that defensive intensity and playmaking and havoc creation against some of the top NBA guards? I think he probably will. I think he's that good of a defender. I just want to make sure we see that continue for him. And maybe can he do a little bit more off the dribble if teams really hone in on locking down Franz Wagner and Paolo Banchero? We discussed Wendell Carter Jr. last week. Does he make an impact on this team, or is he more passenger? And does he even see his minutes shaved off a little bit as the Magic struggle offensively and they move to Mo Wagner off the bench. I don't want to sound like I'm too sour on the Magic. They are a first-time playoff team, and first-time playoff teams with their core normally struggle. So they, no matter honestly how bad they look, they'll probably get a little bit of a mulligan from me. At the same time, as we touched on the top of the show, just tracking how these players perform and adapt will be interesting. I'm expecting the Magic to be a slog on offense and it to be a rock fight, compete defensively, but lose their series pretty decently and handily. But if that isn't the case, if we see some of these players step up and perform well, it will probably change my opinions a little bit in a positive manner. Even though I don't want to overreact to a playoff setting, as I said earlier, this would be a case where if they succeed and how they succeed, that will be crucial for some of these dynasty outlooks and perspectives. The second team we're going to keep an eye out for in the first round are the Indiana Pacers. And they're a little bit of the anti-Magic. All offense with some questionable improving defense, but it's still a pretty questionable defense. Like the Magic, the Pacers have their first playoffs with this core. So we got to keep an eye on Tyrese Haliburton and how he stacks up. We saw him have an incredible first half of the season where he was really this offensive engine, was in the top five of my MVP, and really just looked dynamic, not just passing the ball, but also getting into inside, scoring, and with his pull-up three game. Now, obviously, the second half of the season, he's fallen off, as it's pretty clear he's still dealing with some after effects from the hamstring injury he suffered. But we have to see how defenses play him, and how does he react and adapt to that. My one quibble on Tyrese Haliburton has been almost a hesitancy to really try to get in, score, and take that shot for himself. He kind of passes out more than I would like to see from a first option. We saw him be more aggressive with his shot in the first half, but with him dealing with that hamstring injury, that fell off a little bit in the second half. Will he be able to pick that back up and pick up that intensity and that aggression and that scoring mindset? I don't think he will due to some of the hamstring injury and how defensive play him, but I'd like to see it. I'd like to see if it happens. Can we see Miles Turner be more of a defensive deterrent? The Pacers' defensive schemes and systems do not do him any favors. They kind of sell out to defend the three-point line, and they give up a bevy of easy rim looks as a result. And Miles Turner can't be everywhere. I do think some of his defensive rim ability has gone down a little bit. But again, it's hard to separate the defensive schemes and his individual ability in that regard. At the same time, I'd like to see if he can be that defensive deterrent and see him wall off the rim a little better. How does Pascal Siakam perform? Obviously, we've seen him in the playoffs before. He's been an NBA champion. But how does he perform now in a new environment? And really, haven't seen the playoffs in some time. I'm interested to see if he can step up his game and be a leader for this team and help relieve the pressure if Tyrese Haliburton can't bring it fully on the offensive end. And then just how does the whole bevy of depth players stack up? You have players like Aaron Nesmith, Jalen Smith, Andrew Nembhard. Will they be able to step up? Will they be able to just compete defensively at that level? We talked about how the Pacers' defense has been questionable, and will these players help be a part of that, or will they just not be good enough? You can add an Obi Toppin to that list as well. So Aaron Nesmith, Jalen Smith, Andrew Nembhard, Obi Toppin, will they be capable enough, or will they falter a little bit and indicate that the Pacers need to make some further upgrades to their rotation? I think they'll be interesting to track if those players are up to snuff for the Indiana Pacers. I think that they'll probably falter a little bit, depending on their matchup. But it could be a barn burner of a series, and I'm excited to see how it plays out and how it folds out. That will do it for this episode of the Pun Intended podcast. As we move into the playoffs, we'll start switching up the segments a little bit. We'll still touch on what we've seen from the playoffs in that past week, what games we've seen, and what conclusions we can draw, if any. But we'll start getting into in-depth scouting profiles. and I'm pretty sure we're going to start that next week. I'm excited to get into two of what I think will be the better on-ball guards in this draft. And so I'll leave you guessing to who they'll be, but I am very excited to talk about them next week. With that said, enjoy the NBA play-in games, and we'll see you next week.